Good morning, Connecticut, to our friends across the Sound. It's John Vocat, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. This morning, we're heading out to Newtown to learn more about school-based health centers with the Connecticut Institute for Communities. We'll chat with CIFC founder and CEO, its school-based health center program manager, and Newtown Middle School's principal as he accepts CIFC's Community Leadership Award, recognizing Newtown's efforts to implement a school-based health center at his school and its subsequent success. Then we'll catch up with the director of Connecticut's ACLU office to talk about their latest report, Earning Trust, Addressing Police Misconduct Complaints in Connecticut, the second ACLU Connecticut statewide account of issues with the police complaint processes here in the state. And we'll close with the commissioner of Connecticut's Water Planning Council, who will be promoting several upcoming workshops and public forums to help advance the first comprehensive state water plan as Connecticut addresses water resource management, including ongoing issues with climate change, drought, and water use. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vocat, right after this reminder. The Big Brothers, Big Sisters of Southwestern Connecticut Foundation and Stuffster are teaming up to help keep apparel out of landfills and recycle it through a partnership with Savers to benefit their mentoring programs and making it even easier for BBBS supporters to find nearby donation facilities. The Stuffster app matches things you're not using to nearby organizations that reuse or recycle them. And Big Brothers, Big Sisters of Southwestern Connecticut is the first major charity to distribute this co-branded Stuffster app to its supporters. So get the app and start donating your stuff with Stuffster. And for details on this, other programs, and mentoring opportunities, visit bbbsswct.org. We're here in Newtown today celebrating the intersection of health and education. We're so pleased to be joined here today by Newtown Middle School Principal Tom Einhorn. Jim Maloney's with us, longtime friend, former U.S. representative, and now working with the Connecticut Institute for Communities. We're also joined by Melanie Bonjour, who's the school-based health center program manager. The Institute is the only not-for-profit community development organization in Western Connecticut combining healthcare, education, human services, and housing in a coordinated approach. The CIFC strengthens families and builds communities that support the health and social quality of our area residents. So today we're here celebrating the Newtown Middle School's school-based health center. And before we talk a little bit about that, let me just bring Mr. Maloney in here to give us a little bit more of an expanded view of the Institute and how today's event sort of dovetails into your bigger mission. Jim?
Well, John, nice to be with you again. Appreciate it, the opportunity to talk to you and to your audience. The Connecticut Institute runs a series of health programs. We have a federally qualified health center, which is located in downtown Danbury, doing pediatrics, adult medicine, women's health, behavioral health, and dental services. We also conduct a series of early childhood programs, Head Start, Early Head Start, School Readiness. So indeed, we do both health education. We also manage and develop low and moderate income housing. And part of what we do, of course, is our school-based health center program. We have five school-based health centers in the greater Danbury area, including the one in Newtown that we're here today to recognize both Principal Einhorn and First Select Woman Lodra for their great help in making sure that the school-based health center at Newtown Middle School has been a very marked success.
So does the Newtown program sort of represent a little bit of a departure in terms of what people may think about in terms of need for a school-based health center, in that it is sort of removed from the urban environment and now is sort of in the kind of suburban, semi-rural community?
There are suburban school-based health centers in Connecticut. There are more urban-based school-based health centers, but there are some suburban school-based health centers. What we've noted here in Newtown is that the mix of requested services is a little bit different. In the urban environment, we get much more call for health and dental services than we do in a suburban health center. But in contrast, here in Newtown, we're getting a much larger call for behavioral health counseling, mental health support services. That is not coincidental, given the Sandy Hook tragedy. In part, the school-based health center that we opened here is an effort to make sure that mental health, behavioral health services for children continue as some of the initial response either phases down or phases out. We wanted to make sure there was a permanent response on the behavioral health side. And that's been mirrored and reflected in the fact that that has been the predominant call for services at the school-based health center at the Newtown Middle School.
As we said during the introduction, the Institute is the only not-for-profit community development organization in Western Connecticut combining healthcare, education, and human services and other initiatives, Jim. But do you have counterparts either in single communities or in regions that do similar work throughout the state?
There actually is no other organization in Connecticut quite like the Connecticut Institute. It is a unique approach where we're trying to integrate health, education, housing, sort of basic human needs into one organization that can provide resources for those needs on a coordinated basis. But there are counterparts for individual parts of the program. For example, there are 15 other federally qualified health centers around the state, many of whom do run school-based health centers. So there are other programs that do components of what we do. We are unique in the state of Connecticut in the integration of the services that we provide.
And you've been involved since its inception?
Yes. I actually founded the organization in 2003 and have been with it for its development for the last, it's getting on to almost 20 years.
And since its inception, Jim, can you just tell us a little bit about what you've seen in terms of outcomes of the work that you're doing when you put this kind of unique package together, particularly in integrating education and health delivery?
Well, as both Tom and Melanie can attest even better than I can, it's clear that children who aren't healthy can't learn. If you're not feeling well, if you're feeling sick, if you're depressed, or if you have other emotional or behavioral problems, then your education tends to not be the top of your mind. You're dealing with your health concerns. So what we're doing is not only are we providing a direct service in that we are addressing those health issues, but in turn that makes it possible for those children to learn, and that means that their path forward in life, the doors that then can open for them, are much greater.
And do you find the integration of housing and other human services and SNAP all part of the bigger solution to some of the challenges that are facing the individuals who come under the umbrella of Institute programming?
Sure. The in Connecticut and in Fairfield County in particular, wage rates have a hard time keeping up with housing costs. So if you're going to provide services for your children, if you're going to put food on the table, if you're going to make sure that they have the opportunity to participate in sports or whatever other activities, after-school dance programs, music programs, whatever, you are going to find if you're working in an hourly wage job, you're going to be pretty stretched. So by making sure that families have access to affordable housing, that makes the rest of their burdens all the easier to carry.
Great. We'll come back and talk to Jim Maloney. He's the founder and representative of the Connecticut Institute for Communities Incorporated, CIFC. We're here today in Newtown celebrating Patricia Lodra, the first selectman of Newtown, as well as a gentleman who's sitting here with me, Tom Einhorn. He's principal at Newtown Middle School, the home of the healthcare center that is being celebrated today. Tom Einhorn, thanks for joining us. Tell us a little bit about what you have seen in terms of outcomes at the micro level, right in your school community. Have you been an administrator in other schools that have only had the conventional nurse's office? I mean, in other words, is this the first school that has had that kind of full-blown medical support initiative?
So thankful that you have, we have this opportunity to share the great things that are happening in the middle school. In my past history as a school administrator, I've had experience with the typical nurse, but one of my close friends is also in a building that has a school-based health center. That was in East Hartford.
Oh, okay.
So when I had the opportunity to hear that there was a possibility of having a school-based health center at our school, I jumped at the chance to say, you know, we're all in. So we know that just the timeliness of support for students is remarkable. So we have students that can immediately be seen, and that if they're troubled, we don't want to delay any sort of support we can give to them. So this has been a tremendous boom for our school to have this school-based health center in our building, and we're so thankful for it.
Does your nursing office fold into it, or does it act independently?
That's a great question. So one of the things that we do is that students typically go to our school counselors or to our nurse first, and if they're seen to need a little bit of extra care, that's where the school-based health center comes right in. So it's been seamless. Strategically, we have the school-based health center literally right across the hall from our nurse's office and right down the hallway from our school counseling offices. So the trip is just mere steps, so that the collaboration between all of them has been remarkable.
And what's the personnel makeup of the school-based health center?
There are three staff members, so as students come in, they're greeted by Nancy, who quickly ascertains what needs to happen, and then they're seen by either the nurse practitioner or the social worker that are part of that that office. So there are three staff people.
How often do you find, without getting granular or into specific cases, how often do you find that you're seeing referrals, or do you see these personnel providing support that sort of splashes over beyond healthcare delivery?
Well, I think it's a continuum of services. So we know that there are times when, a student may need just an opportunity to talk and kind of refocus, get some strategies to deal with what's going on, and then some students need some additional supports after that. So sometimes it's a matter of where they would see one of our school counselors. But then if a student needs additional support, maybe ongoing, long-term, maybe that's when the school-based health center's social worker may, book a time where they check in with the students once a week or whatever works best for that student.
So having been an administrator in schools that only have a conventional school nurse's office and now being part of a school with a school-based health center, can you tell me a little bit about the end result, once again, the outcomes of cases? Do you find that more kind of wrapping and comprehensive delivery of services puts either the student or their family or the entire school community ahead of the game in terms of responding to and dealing with an individual child's health challenges?
I think, again, as I said earlier, it's the timeliness. So this is something where we can actually have kids seen within a day, as opposed to sometimes taking a week or more for an outside service organization to see a child. So this is something that we see is really beneficial. So when we've identified that there are certain things going on where a child needs to be seen, it's really the kid can be seen the same day, as opposed to maybe, as I said earlier, waiting weeks and trying to find a provider. So this has been seamless.
Excellent. Tom Einhorn is principal at Newtown Middle School. Tom, thank you so much for taking part in the program today. We appreciate you being here, and congratulations on the great work you're doing at Newtown Middle School. We're wrapping up our visit with folks from the Connecticut Institute for Communities. I'd like to introduce Melanie Bonjour. She is the school-based health center project manager for the Institute. So, Melanie, I just wanted to wrap up with you first, because in our prior conversation before we went on mic, you were kind of talking about some of the unique programs that Newtown Middle School has been doing as kind of a component or complement to the service delivery. And you mentioned something about a get-together kind of meal and workshopping situation. Can you talk a little bit about that? And then we'll kind of broaden the focus to the entire region that you serve.
Sure, I'm happy to share all of the information about all of the services offered in the school-based health center. The school-based health center is there to provide services to any student in the school. Anyone that's enrolled in that particular school is eligible, and as a result of that, we try to reach out to all of the students in the school to promote the availability of the services. And in doing that, we reach out to the students at times when they're not in the classroom. We have a program that we've introduced called Dine and Discover with the school-based health center staff. And the all of the staff go into the student cafeteria on a monthly basis and set up a booth, an educational booth that focuses on a topic or a health-related topic that's relevant to the students, what they may be experiencing, as well as to align with the health education curriculum. So they work with the health teachers and the phys ed teachers in the school to come up with topics. Just recently, they focused in the month of December on the health issue of depression and provided information to students on signs of depression, what to do if you feel depressed, who to contact, if you have friends who are depressed, where to refer them. And they have a question and answer period. They have a contest that they use to engage the students and draw them to the booth, as well as incentives. And it brings a face-to-face contact. The students get to interact with the staff, get to meet the staff. The faculty get to see the staff, and it creates a nice connection with the students. And what we've found in doing these types of events is that we reach a lot of students, and they often come to the school-based health center with questions that they might have not have asked, or with concerns that they might not have addressed if the school-based health center wasn't there and if the opportunities didn't present themselves.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that's really great, I find, is that school-based health centers, at least as operated by the Connecticut Institute for Communities, are supported by your agency, is that they are not specifically and exclusively taxing to the residents and communities in which they exist, by virtue of the fact that they are, a chartered or a set-aside operation within the school district, there's an opportunity for them to be a little bit more self-sustaining through their connection to services like Husky and Medicaid.
Yep, we do. We do receive state funding for this particular site. It certainly doesn't fully fund the health center, but we do bill Husky insurances and some private insurances to help to offset the costs of operational costs. So they aren't taxing on those families. With the intent of the school-based health centers, by placing them in the schools, is to remove barriers to access to care. And one of them can be the concerns about copays. It could be about financial limitations on insurances. And we leverage funds. We creatively bill and seek other sources of funds to remove those barriers.
Excellent. Before we wrap up, Jim, we got about a minute or two left. As we kind of move into this brave new world under the new administration in Washington, with nothing but question marks on the horizon in terms of the availability of access to health care for millions, do you see your initiative at the Institute and the school-based health centers, as well as the community health centers that you folks so fantastically support, as being even more important, or maybe in some cases, depending on the future and what it holds, being even an exclusive conduit for individuals to get the kind of care that they need, our young children in the school environments?
I think that's a very good question, John, and I think it's a very difficult one to answer. I just don't think we have enough data yet to know. We do know a couple of things, some of which are encouraging and some of which are not encouraging. One thing that's encouraging is that the federally qualified health center movement, which is within our organization, is the umbrella organization on health care, which includes the school-based health centers. That movement goes back 45 years, and so it well predates the Affordable Care Act and has very broad bipartisan support. Obviously, in urban situations, there may be a lot of Democrats who support the program, but in many rural communities, a federally qualified health center can be the only primary care provider in the county, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. So it does have broad bipartisan support. So I am hopeful that that will continue. To the extent that other resources for health care are diminished, that may very well push or impel or encourage people to take advantage of federally qualified health centers. That's true. So that may be the part of the positive dynamic. The negative dynamic is that the Affordable Care Act extended Medicaid coverage to many, many low-income families, roughly 20 million nationwide. If that coverage is eliminated, then you can't do it for free. You know, the doctors do get paid. The nurses get paid. There's costs for vaccines. There's costs for medications. There's costs for supplies. There's costs for space. There'll have to be some substantial alternative to that. So I think that's a real problem. It's easy to say repeal and replace, but there's never been a real discussion or a real identification of what replacement means and who's going to pay for it. So I think we're into a troubling situation, but we'll watch it and we'll advocate for the benefit of our patients as much as we can.
Excellent. Well, something to keep an eye on for certain. Jim Maloney, President and CEO of the Connecticut Institute for Communities Incorporated. We were also pleased to welcome to the program Melanie Bonjour. She is their school-based health center program manager at the Institute, and also here today celebrating First Selectman Pat Lodra and of Newtown, and Thomas Einhorn, principal at Newtown Middle School, home of one of the CIFC community-based health centers right here in Newtown. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Well, lacking a gathering of the vibes last summer, we were not in a position to catch up with our friends from the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union Connecticut office, until now. And as I was discussing with our guest just a moment ago before we turned on the mic, it's exciting to be able to say today, as we are recording this on Thursday, we are in possession of the latest ACLU Connecticut report called Earning Trust, Addressing Police Misconduct Complaints in Connecticut. This is the second ACLU statewide account of issues with police complaint processes in Connecticut. And, you know, for each of the last 4 years, Connecticut has enacted laws to improve police-community relations. And one of the laws passed back in 2014 was working to build public trust by making the police complaint process more transparent and accessible. We're going to find out how we're doing with our guest this morning, David McGuire, Executive Director, ACLU Connecticut. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Didn't get pulled over on the way into work this morning, right?
No, well, hopefully I can get home okay.
Yeah, right. Well, this is playing on Sunday, so if you hunker down and just stay home, you'll be all right.
That'll work.
So, first of all, just to refresh folks' memory on exactly what the ACLU is all about and how the Connecticut component that you head up kind of fits into the larger quilt work of what ACLU is as a movement nationally.
Sure. So the ACLU is a unique organization in that we have a large and robust national office out of New York, and they have a legislative office in D.C., but then there are 53 state affiliates. So we are the Connecticut affiliate. Our jurisdiction is the border of Connecticut, and we get involved in both litigation and legislation to uphold everyone's constitutional rights. So that varies from time to time as to what our focus is, always, you know, the First Amendment and privacy and things like that. But over the last 3 or 4 years, as you mentioned in the intro, we at the ACLU Connecticut have been focusing on police accountability, which remains an issue here, and this report brings out some of the problems that we're trying to grapple with.
So is this report and the protocol and rubric in which it was created, is this something that's sort of transferable? So in other words, one or more of the other 52 statewide ACLU offices has utilized the template, if you will, to develop similar reports in their own states?
We do often share concepts like that, and we definitely learn from each other's mistakes and successes. We were the first state in the country back in 2014 to pass a comprehensive police complaint law, which is the one that we're doing this follow-up report on. But there have been other affiliates that have taken our lead. And since the Ferguson incident, this has been an issue that a lot of state affiliates have grappled with.
Excellent. Let me then get to the report itself, or at least the building process. This, as we indicated in the introduction, is the second one?
That's right. Yeah, we did an original report in December of 2012. In that report, we called the non-emergency number for every police department in the state, as well as all the state police troops at each barrack. And we asked list of 10 questions, and the questions range from questions about where to get the form, if there were time limits, if folks could file an anonymous complaint. One that was really troubling was the caller would ask if someone has a documentation issue with their immigration, would they be able to file a form? Would there be repercussions? And quite a few departments said that we'll contact ICE or you'll be detained or don't come in without a lawyer. So really chilling people's access to the process. And ultimately, we put together a report and had several recommendations that were in 2014 adopted into law in large part. And what ended up happening was the Connecticut legislature, in recognizing that they're not law enforcement officials, deferred to POST, which is the Police Officer Standards and Training Council, to come up with a model policy that would have to be either met or exceeded by every department in the state. And POST, to their credit, put together a pretty good policy. It mandates that anonymous complaints be accepted, which is best practice. It does not impose time limits. It has a component where police complaints have to be numbered and tracked. Unfortunately, what we found is that a lot of departments are not complying with those common sense standards.
So is this a comprehensive study across every certified law enforcement agency in the state? Are these just municipal police departments, state police, campus police? How is this broken down?
Yep. So this is these are all departments that to your first point, certified. There are only a couple dozen departments that are actually certified by the state or by national accreditation agencies. We as a state don't require our departments to be certified. Officers themselves are certified every 3 years, but that's another area that we really can improve in terms of professionalizing law enforcement. The 102 police agencies that we surveyed back in 2012, and then we looked at their websites this year to see if they posted the form and policy on their website, which they're required to do by law and policy, are the agencies that are kind of thought of as the real agencies. This is not security guards. This is municipal, state police, and then some campus police departments. So these are the departments that have certified law enforcement officers. And again, we found pretty consistent shortcomings on all of these departments.
So then bring us through the I guess I should ask, were there any modifications or changes to either the sort of the flow and the template of the report from mm-hmm. your previous one? Did you take from the previous one and make changes?
Great question. So this survey is a little bit more truncated. It's a little shorter, and we did not call every department. What we did was, as I mentioned, go on every department's website. We did a thorough review of the website. We actually did it twice on every website to see if we could find the complaint form and policy. We identified 40 departments out of the 102 that did not have either the form, the policy, or both, and we chose those to call. We also chose to call the top 10 departments by size of community they serve. We at the ACLU of Connecticut last year have done a number of these Know Your Rights events focused on police interaction, so letting people know about your Fourth Amendment rights, search and seizure, and all that. And a big component of those events was hearing from the public what their concerns were with law enforcement. And pretty uniformly throughout the state, people were frustrated with a lack of transparency and a lack of accountability. So that flagged for us we needed to follow up. The reason we chose the top 10 by size of community they serve is because that's where we got a lot of that kind of negative feedback. So we called those departments and asked a shorter list of questions, essentially to see if they were in compliance with the law. Because when we first did this report, there was no regulation of police complaints at all. And again, we found that a lot of departments, either the person that answered the non-emergency line didn't know the information about the complaint process, which is a problem, or they gave the information in a very, very confusing or intimidating way. So we believe that one of the things that needs to happen is better training of personnel that come into contact with the public.
So the complaints came straight to ACLU from frontline individuals who either had filed complaints themselves or knew someone who did and wanted to review them?
That was the feedback that prompted us to do the follow-up at these Know Your Rights events, and as well as just general feedback that we got through our regular intake process. We were getting a pretty consistent message that people were still having problems lodging these complaints. And I myself know someone who's actually an activist in the southeast part of the state who herself filed a racial profiling complaint, and that department reported that they had not received any complaints that year. So there are some issues here that need to be dealt with. And, you know, a lot of it is public awareness, the public knowing that they should be allowed or they are allowed by policy and law to file an anonymous complaint. Especially in a lot of the urban communities, folks are very hesitant to file a complaint because they don't want to have retaliation happen to them or their family.
We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk some more with David McGuire, Executive Director of the ACLU Connecticut office, about their latest report, Earning Trust, Addressing Police Misconduct Complaints in Connecticut. Stick with us. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. And if you work or volunteer with a state nonprofit, visit the site to apply for one of our 2017 Love CT Foundation grants. This is Director of Public Affairs John Boquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. As we start focusing on Heart Month in February, we invite you to meet an exercise physiologist for the cardiac rehabilitation programs at New Milford and Danbury Hospitals discussing risk factors for heart disease. It's coming up Thursday, February 23rd at 6 p.m. at New Milford Hospital. This free lecture follows a 5 p.m. senior supper in the hospital cafe. New Milford Hospital, in cooperation with area senior centers, offers senior suppers on weekdays in the hospital dining room. For $5, seniors show their senior center ID card and can enjoy a healthy, well-balanced meal. For information, visit WCHN.org. We're back with David McGuire, Executive Director of ACLU Connecticut, talking about their latest report, Earning Trust, Addressing Police Misconduct Complaints in Connecticut. A lot of great information in this report we will not be able to get to, of course, in the next few minutes that we have left with David McGuire, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union office here in Connecticut. Today, as we record the program, and just a couple of days before broadcast, they released their latest update, Earning Trust, Addressing Police Misconduct Complaints in Connecticut. If you'd like to review it yourself, please do. It's at aclucT.org/earningtrust. aclucT.org/earningtrust. So, David, let's drill into the report a little bit more deeply. Were there any trends that you were able to identify in terms of the specifics or the many moving parts between an incident that may spur a complaint, the individual's process of coming forward and trying to file it, the processing internally at police departments, or the availability of information after the fact to go to look back on and maybe track trends? You know, were any of these or any other trends that you saw kind of emerging or on an upward trajectory of occurrence versus level or downward?
That's a great question. So one of the difficulties that we have is that there's not a whole lot of information or data on police complaints in Connecticut. We know we have a lot of anecdotes, but we really need some hard data. So one of the things that we recommend in this report is that there be comprehensive reporting by every department each year to the state of Connecticut about how many complaints they receive, what types of complaints those are, you know, for example, racial profiling, excessive force, and then a generalized summary of the disposition. So the Hartford Police would say we received 100 complaints, 50 of them were, you know, excessive force, and of those we upheld 10. So that the public really has an idea of how many complaints are being lodged and what the outcomes are. That information will be truly helpful, and we can reference some work that we've done in Connecticut on taser reform. We passed a law 3 years ago on taser safety where every department now needs to train officers on how to use a taser, but also submit a use of force report every time they fire one. And we just got the first year of data under that, and we found some trends we expected. There were racial disparities in who they're used on. But we also found that 50% of the people tasers are used on are either in mental health crisis or suicidal, per the officer's observation. We never would have gotten to that if not for the reporting. So one of the things that we're hoping the legislature will do is to require the reporting, which will go a long way and help administrators at the departments as well kind of understand trends, just as you were saying. That's one of the big takeaways from this report. We don't have enough data.
Yeah, and I guess that in and of itself as one standalone example really does transcend legal, constitutional, and splashes over into public health and quality of life as well. So the tracking of that kind of incident an outcome is certainly critical, well beyond your realm, and that's why this report is so important. We only have a few more minutes left with you, David McGuire, but I also wanted to kind of flip things over. We've got 169 towns and cities here in Connecticut, probably approaching or maybe even beyond 200 different types of law enforcement organizations that have rights of arrest here in the state of Connecticut, or at least approaching 200. So what's the good news in this report?
Well, the good news is that there is an evolving relationship between law enforcement in Connecticut and civil liberties advocates. So I've worked closely with the NAACP of Connecticut for a number of years, and I'll tell you that back 6 or 7 or 8 years ago, we were just butting heads with law enforcement and we weren't able to work on anything together. We're now at a point where over the past couple of years we've worked on bills together in terms of excessive force, racial profiling. So the good news is that there is some more receptivity on the part of law enforcement, and I think they are really understanding due to some unfortunate national examples in Baltimore and Ferguson, Missouri, and New York, that if we don't really work on the community trust aspect, everyone is going to be less safe, law enforcement and the community. So I do really expect them to take this police complaint report to heart. I've distributed this before it was made public to law enforcement, and I expect that we'll work on this together.
So we've only got about a minute or so left with you, David. But in closing, the kinds of incidents that we have seen proliferate around the nation don't really seem to be happening too much in Connecticut. Does that speak to the heightened level of awareness and concern on the part of both chiefs of police or law enforcement agency administrators and the training officers who are now working?
We've come a long way, and we haven't had that powder keg incident, and hopefully we won't. There are still lots of problems, and we need to do a lot more work. But I do believe that this complaint report is a real key to that, because when people are able to lodge a complaint and law enforcement hears it and acts appropriately, that will diffuse those bad situations. So, that's a kind of roundabout way of saying yes.
Very good. We appreciate you taking some time to speak with us this morning, and we may come back around on this with you. David McGuire is Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union office here in Connecticut. They just released, as we speak today, Earning Trust, Addressing Police Misconduct Complaints in Connecticut. Earning Trust shows that many police agencies fail to clearly post their complaint policies and complaint forms online, refuse to accept anonymous complaints, and include threats of prosecution in their complaint intake protocols. And in some cases, these obstacles violate recent state law and statewide police policy. If you'd like to read the full report, you're welcome to do it. Doesn't cost anything. Go to ACLUCT.org/earningtrust. Dave McGuire, we'll talk to you again soon. Thanks for being on
the program. Thanks so much, John.
Well, we're pleased to be visiting with John Bitkoski. He's chairman of the Water Planning Council and a long-tenured member of the Connecticut PURA, the Public Utilities Regulatory Authority.
Yes, sir.
And we are talking with him today about water. The Connecticut Water Planning Council is in the process of holding workshops and public forums to assist with what they're calling phase two of the development of Connecticut's first state water plan. Before we get into discussing that, Jack, tell us a little bit about your kind of dual roles with PURA and the Planning Council.
First of all, John, thanks for being with me and talking about the Public Utility Regulatory Authority and the statewide water plan. I've been vice chairman of the PURA, as you know, for almost 10 years. And with that, I am very much involved with the regulatory process as it relates to electric and natural gas, telecommunications, cable TV, telephone, and what we're talking about today, water. I regulate privately investor-owned water companies. And one of the things that's happening here is that the governor in the legislature several years ago thought that it'd be time to really look at our water resources here in the state of Connecticut and to develop a comprehensive water plan. There's about 20 states that have it right now, and we have different. We have environmental issues, we have public policy issues, we have economic issues, quite frankly, we have quantity issues now. This year has been a very difficult year in terms of drought. We're about 13 inches below where we should be, and thank goodness lately we've had some rain. So the timeliness of this workshop is very good. I mean, water is kind of out of sight, out of mind. Well, I call it the stepchild of the utilities. Yet we can't live
until it doesn't come out of the
exactly. and we can't live or work or do anything without it. And the timeliness of this work plan is good.
And has really nothing to do. This is not a knee-jerk reaction to the current drought situation, or you know what we saw in Michigan with the lead poisoning concerns. This is something that's been in kind of out on the horizon for the state for several years.
That's an excellent point, John. This has nothing to do with the drought. It just so happens that the drought seems to really provide more impetus to the importance of us coming up with a plan. But this is something that we have been talking about in the state for the last 15 years. But the governor and the legislature and several members of the legislature, Mary Mashinsky and John Hampton and other individuals, really got behind this. Not only with legislation to help us promote a plan, but also with the funding. The big thing was that we did not have funding, so we had over $1 million, $500,000 this year and $500,000 the previous year to come up with this plan. And the wonderful part of this is there are many stakeholders that are involved in this. It gets all the state agencies, Department of Environmental and Energy together, Department of Public Health, PURA, the Office of Policy Management, anybody that has cognizance over water into the same room together, as well as the many, many stakeholders that have involvement in the water industry to come up with a statewide comprehensive plan.
So as you have sat on the regulatory commission here in Connecticut, what are a few of the concerns or issues that you've had to hear about over the past decade? And then, you know, even going beyond that to your service as a state legislator and a resident here in the Naugatuck Valley, what are some of the things that have either been plaguing Connecticut in terms of, you know, shortfalls in practice or policy, or in occasional, you know, not I wouldn't say disasters, but at least, you know, concerns when it comes to water statewide?
One of the things that we are faced with as regulators is the fact that we still have many small water systems in the state of Connecticut. We have about 1,500 systems, believe it or not, in the state of Connecticut. We regulate 50 and more connections at the Public Utility Regulatory Authority. The Department of Public Health, two or more connections is considered, quote, a water company. So our challenge over during my tenure have been to consolidate and collaborate these smaller water companies into one, to go with some of the larger, either the regional and public water companies, the private investor-owned companies, so that we can take the synergies through through the mergers and acquisitions of these companies, because one of the challenges we have also is the pipes in the ground need to be replaced. Many have been in for a long, long time, going in 50, 75, and 100-year cycles. And what's happening is that the perfect storm, a lot of these have to be replaced. We have come up with an adjustment mechanism for private investor-owned companies called WICA, the Water Infrastructure Conservation Adjustment Charge, where the companies can come into us and say, okay, regulators, over the next 3 years, we're going to replace X amount of pipes, and then we can give them the funding to do it. That way we mitigate rate shock in terms of the cost. Nationwide, you're talking about trillions of dollars to replace all the pipes in the ground.
But ultimately, you know, you're looking at, you know, small water companies that must be much more challenged year by year to sustain themselves. You're looking at the big water companies who obviously are extremely successful and sometimes, at least in Connecticut's case, have global resources. And then you have the end users. So the prospect of folding many of these hundreds and hundreds of small water suppliers into larger companies seems like not just a win-win between the two, but also a win for the consumers. It's just sorting out who's going to cover the infrastructure improvement costs.
That's exactly correct. And what we have, too, we have in geographic areas, we call them the Water Utility Coordination Councils. There's three of them that are being established throughout the state of Connecticut. So they're the ones that look at it's almost like a franchise area for water. So you look at these smaller water companies that need to be upgraded because they have the pipes that need to replace or the filtration systems or the tanks. And you're right, the places that the people that own these just don't have the resources. What has happened many, as you and I know, in the 60s and the 70s, many condominiums and home associations were established where they had wells put in, and they were a water company. And the developers got in there, they sold the homes, they made their money. Well, now we have the systems that are left to be taken care of. So that's the challenge that we have to, as regulators and as state officials, is to come in and develop a plan so that it's not going to be rate shock for the people, but they're going to be able to open up the faucet and have good, clean water come out of it.
Have you, since you have national associations and colleagues, have you heard of a state or a county or even a municipality that has developed or is in the process of developing some sort of a equitable plan that makes the improvements and the cost that's associated with them fair for all and metered out in a way that doesn't become burdensome or put the end user, the consumers, into a financial crisis?
Well, Pennsylvania was one of the first states that came out with such a plan, and we've replicated and modified that here in the state of Connecticut in terms of how we'd like to see it happen. The municipal water companies and regional water companies don't have the same mechanism that we do. Going to your question about rate shock. I mean, the question is that if you go and replace millions of dollars of pipe and you don't do it in a thoughtful manner with the ratepayer, they're going to open up the bill and they're going to say, my goodness, what's happening here? So we're trying to do it in sections. We're trying to do it in a thoughtful way so that the ratepayer is not going to be overly burdened and that the companies are going to have the capital needed to go out and to replace the pipe. We also have the Safe Drinking Water Fund, the State Revolving Fund, which is a federal program, and that remains to be seen, quite frankly, with the change in administration, if that money is going to be available. But that has been available for some pipe replacement and upgraded filtration plants and equipment and things of that nature.
We've got 7 or 8 minutes left, and we're having a really educational conversation with John Betkoski. Jack Betkoski is chairman of the Water Planning Council. He's also the longest tenured commissioner and vice chair of PURA, the Public Utility Regulatory Authority, and next year will become an officer with the National Association of Utility Regulators. Congratulations on
that,
Jack.
Very exciting.
So on Thursday, January 12th, the first of 4 state water plan workshops was held up in Storrs at UConn. Did you attend that or hear about it? And can you tell us a little bit about the first volleys across the net in terms of input or ideas from people who may have shown up not knowing what to expect, the end users? Did you have a lot of consumers or a few there?
We had a combination. Yes, I was there, and as was my colleague. I have colleagues on the Water Planning Council, which I should acknowledge is Dave Levasseur, the Undersecretary of the Office of Policy Management, is Vice Chair. Betsy Wingfield, the Bureau Chief at the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, represents that department or agency. And then we have Lori Matthew, who works for the Department of Public Health. So the 4 of us are there. And we had people there from private investor-owned companies, publicly owned companies. We had environmentalists there, people that might be involved with Trout Unlimited, with recreational facilities. We had people, we had a good cross-section from the academic world, UConn professors that are very much involved in water issues. Our facilities from C.D. Smith, who are our consultants at the program. And basically, we come up with there's 17 items that the legislature have asked us to look at. We've been that's our roadmap to come up with the plan. And throughout the course of the morning, we had individuals speak and give their suggestions as to how we ought to develop the plan. One of the things that we have is there's a lot of, as you know, we have a lot of rivers and we have a lot of waterways. And we have a lot of ponds. We have brooks. Is that, you know, we want to protect them. We want to protect the wildlife and that utilize that, but we also have to, you know, we have to make sure that we have enough potable water available. We have to look at perhaps reuse of water, reuse of gray water. And as you know, with my role, you have the water energy nexus because you need lots of water many times for power plants and things of that nature. So all that goes hand in hand. And those are the kind of issues that we're dealing with is quantity, quality, and how we can effectively use it to provide water in all areas of our life, including economic development.
Excellent. Well, citizen participation and input is critical to developing and implementing a plan that meets the needs of all the stakeholders while protecting the valuable resource of Connecticut's water. If you're interested in participating in one of the water plan workshops coming up, they are over the course of 3 Thursdays, 2 in February on the 2nd and 16th, and then on April 20th. They all run from 1 to 5 p.m., and they are all at the PURA headquarters meeting room on Franklin Square in New Britain. In addition, there are public meetings that are being held, including the next one as this show broadcasts. There are 2 left on Thursday, February 23rd at the state, at the Southbury Town Hall on Main Street South, and then one on Thursday, April 13th at the PURA hearing room in New Britain. Both of these run from 1 to 3 p.m. Now, Jack, what's the difference between the planning workshops and the public meetings? Is one just more like a hearing while the other one has much more kind of hands-on,
exactly,
heads-on involvement with some of the more intricate players in the mix?
That's exactly correct. The workshops are really when you roll up your sleeves and look at the plan and look at the proposed plans and look at the pieces that were required to come up and address and debate them and come up with consensus. When we were up in UConn a couple weeks ago, we actually voted and prioritized different areas of the plan, and facilitators did a great job at that. When you look at the public meetings, which we're going to have three of, that's really a hearing. That's really for people to come out. We give an overview of where we're at, give them a status update to the water plan, what we've crossed so far, what our time frame is. You know, hope to get this. We want to get this completed by July 1st, and then between July 1st and the end of December of 17, we'll be kind of doing a roadshow, going out, doing more hearings, and then present it to the legislature in January of 2018 for a vote. And believe it or not, we're right on schedule, and that's a good thing. Sometimes, as you know, when you do these types of projects, you hit delays here and there because of money or personnel. But so far, we're right on target.
And hopefully in about a year, this will be handed over, just under a year, this will be handed over to the General Assembly post-deadline in July. So once again, if you'd like more information or to be reminded about where the workshops and the meetings are, you can go to the you can jump off of the PURA site, ct.gov/PURA, for the Public Utilities Regulatory Authority. But the Connecticut Water Planning Council also has its own page, which you could web search Connecticut Water Planning Council. We hope folks will consider coming out. As Commissioner Bitkoski said, you don't really miss your water till you go to turn on the tap or, God forbid, are late for work and running into the shower and nothing comes out of the other end. So if you care about water and the water quality that will sustain Connecticut and your loved ones and communities well into the future, please consider coming out to one of these events. Once again, Thursday, February 23rd at the Southbury Town Hall from 1 to 3, or April 13th from 1 to 3 at the PURA Hearing Room on Franklin Square in New Britain. Those are the public meetings, and the three remaining water plan workshops, February 2nd, February 16th, and April 20th, all from 1 to 5 p.m. at the PURA offices on Franklin Square in New Britain. Commissioner Bitkoski, thanks for all the great information, and we'll be talking to you again soon.
John, thank you very much, and I encourage everybody to come out to these workshops and these public hearings, particularly the one in April, because that's when we're really getting towards the end of the journey to develop this plan. I encourage people to attend that one.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scotts, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.